Welcome, and thank you for standing by. At this time, all participants are on a listen-only mode. During the question-and-answer session, please press star one on your touch-tone phone. Today's conference is being recorded. If you have any objections, you may disconnect at this time. Thank you, and you may begin.
Hello, and welcome to today's FDA webinar to discuss the final guidance document titled IDEs for Early Feasibility Medical Device Clinical Studies, including First in Human. Your presenters today are Andrew Farb and Dorothy Abel, both of the Office of Device Evaluation, Division of Cardiovascular Devices. Following their presentation, we will open the call to questions. Now I'll turn the call over to Andrew Farb.
Good day, everyone. I'm happy to present a brief overview of the guidance on investigational device exemptions for early feasibility medical device clinical studies. So to begin, there are clear opportunities associated with conducting early feasibility studies in the United States. When performed in the United States, these studies allow for contact between investigators, developers, inventors, and regulators in geographically closer locations and in a more collaborative fashion. We need to keep the patient in the center of our focus, and when these studies are performed in the United States, they allow for access of promising new technology earlier in the device development process, in a more continuous fashion from early feasibility studies through pivotal trials, and then expanded dissemination once beneficial devices are approved for use in the general population. FDA's goals in this effort are to provide the earliest and broadest patient access to beneficial medical devices and maintain or regain U.S. leadership in innovation. But prevailing currents need to be recognized. Initial clinical testing of novel devices has been moving to non-U.S. sites. Device innovation may follow overseas, and we now know that some devices are being exclusively developed for non-U.S. markets. There are real-world consequences to these developments. There can be a palpable time lag in the availability of some beneficial medical devices for U.S. patients. And there are real human costs associated with delaying access to new technology, particularly in the context of limits of current available treatment options. What are some of the barriers to innovating in the United States? There may be insufficient predictability of what information is needed to allow for the initiation of clinical studies. Data requirements may be difficult to identify when we are dealing with increasingly complex devices, when there are no established guidance or standards for innovative devices, or no generally accepted method for justifying data requirements. There may be ineffective communication between CDRH and industry, and there can be poor quality data submissions that do not include or coherently describe relevant information. In providing direction for this guidance, FDA recognizes the value of encouraging medical device innovation to address clinical needs and improve patient care. We are committed to improving U.S. patient access to new devices by strengthening and streamlining the clinical trial enterprise, and we focus our efforts on promoting public health. The guidance adopts a new framework, the core principle of which is the application of benefit-risk principles throughout regulatory decision-making. In this framework, we keep the clinical context at the forefront. By applying this framework, this allows our regulators to consider the totality of the benefit-risk profile for the device, for example, the disease condition, and the limitations and risks associated with currently available treatment alternatives. It also incorporates an understanding that patients tolerate risk differently and embraces their perspective on the potential benefits of new technologies, and also finally includes risk mitigation strategies when balancing risks and benefits. With the early feasibility guidance, this was developed to facilitate the clinical evaluation of medical devices in the U.S. under the current IDE regulations, using risk mitigation strategies that appropriately protect human subjects. So what is an early feasibility study? These are studies that involve a small number of subjects for a device intended for a specific indication that may be early in its development, typically before the device design has been finalized. An early feasibility study, however, does not necessarily involve the first clinical use of the device. The guidance should be viewed as a regulatory toolkit that enables sponsors and regulators to think in new ways about device development, the appropriate evidence needed to move from bench to clinical study, and the implementation of timely device and clinical protocol modifications. The key principle of the guidance is that approval of an early feasibility IDE may be based on less non-clinical data. That is, for some new devices, exhaustive non-clinical testing would not likely provide the information needed to further device development. And in these cases, early clinical use of the device in a limited number of subjects is needed to provide initial insights into clinical safety and device function, inform subsequent clinical and non-clinical testing, and or improve device performance through iteration before finalizing the design. A guiding principle of the early feasibility study is a term we call just-in-time testing, and this is a term that we borrowed and modified from industrial production. Just-in-time testing applies to the type and timing of non-clinical testing needed to justify study initiation. It departs from the custom of expecting exhaustive non-clinical testing prior to any clinical use, and it recognizes that comprehensive testing during the early phases of device development may add cost without important return. Testing could have limited future applicability if the device is modified. Time-consuming, non-informative testing delays access to devices for patients who may have limited treatment alternatives. Just-in-time testing acknowledges that it may be acceptable to defer some testing until the device design has been finalized for use in a pivotal study. So there are other reasons why just-in-time testing is appropriate for early feasibility studies. An early feasibility study incorporates enhanced risk mitigation strategies and patient protection measures as compared to a pivotal study. We expect that these patients will be highly selected and will receive individualized care and monitoring. Importantly, the guidance does not recommend that sponsors prematurely initiate clinical testing when further useful and appropriate non-clinical testing can be performed to advance the device development, so that an early feasibility study must be supported by an appropriate benefit-risk analysis, including justification for the types and amounts of data needed to support study initiation. How to put just-in-time testing into practice? This is best communicated through a device evaluation strategy, which is submitted within the report of prior investigations that describes and justifies the appropriate testing to support initiation of the clinical study. The device evaluation strategy provides the thinking behind the device development program and justifies what is sufficient rather than testing for the sake of testing. The device evaluation strategy focuses on basic device functionality, that is an expectation of acceptable clinical use that the device will function as intended, and addresses significant safety concerns such as biocompatibility, sterility, chemical compatibility, and characterizes catastrophic failure modes and identifies associated risk mitigation approaches. The device evaluation strategy presents a description of the device concept, including the clinical context for the device design, and identifies device and procedure-related attributes necessary to obtain the desired performance, failure modes that might occur if each attribute is not achieved, how those failures could affect the device or the patient, and what information is needed or available to evaluate the attribute or failure mode. The second most important principle of the guidance is the provision to facilitate changes in the device or the procedure during an early feasibility study. We know that experience and knowledge gained from the initial study subjects can guide device or protocol changes. Rounds of regulatory submissions and review can delay the implementation of beneficial changes and impede study progress. Therefore, the early feasibility study guidance includes new approaches to facilitate timely device and clinical protocol modifications during the study. There are three new approaches outlined in the guidance. First, more changes can be made through five-day notification rather than requiring FDA approval. This is possible because many changes will not affect the interpretation of the results, as the results do not depend on statistical analyses or pooling data among study subjects. The second approach is a method we term contingent approval. This involves approval of anticipated or proposed device changes that can be obtained contingent on the completion of an agreed-upon test plan and reporting the test data. After successful completion of the testing, the sponsor can begin to study the modified device without additional FDA action. Finally, interactive review, which encourages communication between FDA and the sponsor within a 30-day review cycle to address deficiencies and is intended to facilitate timely approval of the IDE. What are the next steps after an early feasibility study is completed? Subsequent clinical evaluation depends on the stability of the device design, the availability of data to justify the next study, and the purpose of the clinical study. So one alternative is expansion of the early feasibility study to additional patients. For example, if further device modifications are expected. Alternatively, either a traditional feasibility study or a pivotal study may be proposed. For a device design that is near final or final, for a case where the early feasibility study data support the initial safety of the device and proof of principle, and there are adequate non-clinical data available. So what's changed from the draft guidance to the finalized guidance that was recently published? We emphasize benefit-risk concepts throughout the document. We improved the report of private investigations section to clarify the information that will be useful to justify study initiation. We added a design control section and included more guidance on drafting the informed consent form for the early feasibility study. And finally, we suggested pre-submission topics for discussion between the sponsor and the FDA. We do recognize our current efforts, and there are some remaining uncertainties. Intra- and extramural training programs are under development. We are hopeful, based on the response we have received to the guidance, in that many sponsors have committed to test the waters conducting early feasibility studies within the United States. There are some outstanding questions. Will other sponsors step up to take the plunge? Is there sufficient value added for doing early feasibility studies within the United States? And are non-regulatory clinical trial challenges surmountable? Here are some references for questions and the web address for the early feasibility study guidance. We look forward to working with you and answering any questions you may have. Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, so we'll take questions from the audience now.
Thank you. We will now begin the question and answer session. If you'd like to ask a question, please press star 1. You'll be prompted to record your name. To withdraw your request, please press star 2. One moment, please, to see if we have any questions.
Connected right now.
We have a question from Raya. Your line is now open.
Oh, hi. Our question is about the correlation between the design control and this IDE feasibility studies. Is it a requirement that these feasibility studies are conducted within the design control structure regulation?
The answer to that is yes, and we did include a design control section in the early feasibility guidance to give an idea of the type of information that would be appropriate at this phase of device development.
Thank you.
Our next question comes from Craig Combs. Your line is open.
Hi. I was curious about the mechanism for the contingent approval. And how will that be better than the typical 30-day supplement that we typically sent in?
So the plan is that if you have an idea of a potential modification in the future and you know how you would evaluate that, you can describe to us how you would do the evaluation and the outcomes that you would need in order to feel that it was appropriate to make the change. And we would approve making the modification based on your plan. So you're actually getting an approval before you do the testing. And it's somewhat like what we have with the shelf life testing currently, where as long as you follow the protocol for shelf life and you get the results that you anticipate, you can change your shelf life time and your labeling without getting an additional approval from FDA. So the benefit is you're getting approval based on a plan. You don't have to wait until you have all the testing completed.
Do you have some sort of timing in mind for how long it should take you to review these contingent plans?
It would be the same as with any other IDE submission, so that if you put in your proposals with your original IDE, you would get some sort of approval of those contingent plans within the 30 days of submitting your original, or if you submit a supplement with the proposed changes, it would be an approval within the 30 days.
Thanks.
So you could be doing your testing while you're waiting for the approval, or, you know, you could be, if you have a plan that you might want to make modification to a component with various modifications over time, and doing the same testing and getting the same results would be necessary, even though the piece would be different. You could get that done well in advance of actually making the modifications and doing the testing.
Terrific. Thank you.
Michael Linderman, your line is open.
Oh, hello. I didn't do the studies before. Just maybe a naive question. How many healthy controls and how many patients you see in studies? I understand it could be calculated from power analysis, but practically, can you give me some, you know, heads up on how many of those people?
So the way we define these early feasibility studies is to point to a limited number of subjects, typically less than 10, to start. For medical devices, and since we're dealing with IDEs and significant risk devices, we usually don't think about healthy controls. That's usually more of a drug question. So I wasn't quite sure what the context of the question was.
Oh, in my case, it's totally non-intrusive device, non-invasive at all. So you answered my question by saying that less than 10, or around 10 subjects would be good enough.
Well, that's the general expectation, that these would be limited investigations, but then there are opportunities to expand to further feasibility work, particularly if you're anticipating making modifications in the device, or if the data support going to a larger type of trial, like a larger feasibility study or even a pivotal trial, to move forward to that framework.
I see. How much usually this study cost, roughly?
I think this study would depend on the type of study and the type of device, but that's usually something that the sponsor would work.
But you're breaking out.
Yeah, that's not something that we would have any control over.
I see. No, I understand. Thank you very much.
Could you repeat the question?
That question comes from Jason Brook. Your line is open.
Hi. I missed the first couple of slides, so I apologize if you covered this. But I realize that the guidance is meant for IDE significant risk studies. To what extent should a sponsor look to this for guidance related to non-significant risk studies, if any at all?
Are
Mr. Brooks, did that address your question?
I'm sorry, I couldn't hear the answer. I didn't realize. I thought maybe you were thinking. Sorry.
Okay. Can you hear me now?
Yes, that's better.
The IDE staff. Non-significant risk studies, whether they're early feasibility or of any other type, do not need to be submitted to FDA for review prior to beginning them. They are submitted to the IRB, which can make a determination, a final determination as to whether or not it's significant risk or not. If the IRB agrees that it's a non-significant risk study, then you can just go ahead at that point with starting with a small number of patients or however many the IRB allots to you. Does that answer your question?
I'm comfortable with you know the your answer. I guess the question is there's a lot of really useful information in this guidance that could help sponsors in their effort to either make the determination of significant risk for not versus non-significant risk, and if it is significant risk, non-significant risk, this guidance could be helpful for both sponsors and the IRB to really kind of guide the obligations of the sponsor to ensure, you know, that there's certain safety and design controls and things like that. But I'm just curious if there's any information or anything here in this guidance that could be valuable for the non-significant risk side of things.
This guidance really doesn't delve into significant, non-significant risk. We do have a separate guidance with pretty much that in the title that's available on the Good Clinical Practice website, and that is entirely based on for significant and non-significant risk determinations. You can also submit a pre-submission to FDA for a study risk determination if you're either the sponsor or IRB are not comfortable with that decision. There are some devices and studies. We look at not only the device but the study, and some of them fall into a gray area, and FDA is very comfortable making the final decision.
Thank you very much.
Anthony Ignani, your line is open.
Thank you. The structure of the submission for the early feasibility study is laid over the structure of a traditional IDE for the initial submission. Is that correct? So we have to have a full traditional IDE submission with the additional elements that are identified in the early IDE, or how does the structure of the submission look?
The structure would be the same, and there isn't additional information required. It's just some guidance on how to address particular elements of an IDE application. So you would always need a report of prior investigations, for example, and this guidance gives you an idea of how to present the information to best make your case regarding justification of an early feasibility study.
Okay. All right. Thank you.
Louis Jimenez, your line is open.
Yes, thank you. I was wondering, in your presentation, you outlined that there's going to be a kind of risk-benefit consideration, and that preclinical testing is always going to be required for early feasibility study. I'm wondering if, for example, there's long-term animal studies and there's a need to start initial human testing, if this would be an avenue, or if the stance is always going to be complete the full preclinical kind of program on safety and biocompatibility and long-term assessment before being able to consider this type of study.
So I think you really get to one of the focuses of the guidance and its intent, and that is to provide the type of testing that is necessary to start a clinical trial. And in some cases, long-term studies might not be necessary to be completed at the time of the initial clinical test. It's really up to you to identify the types of testing that are essential, that are sufficient, and provide a justification of why those tests are sufficient to provide the basic safety and information so that initial human testing can commence. And then to make a justification of why certain tests that might complete the characterization of the device might be appropriately deferred for a later time point.
You also implied that animal studies would always be necessary. Is that what you meant?
Well, I thought that there was a comment in the presentation that stated that there's always never going to be kind of a waiver on these. But I guess from the answer now that there is kind of a balance that we have to hit in terms of not completing the full amount of testing, but at least generating enough data to show comfort level with the risk ratio.
Right.
And this might be a little aggressive, but is there, in general, kind of a percent rule of thumb in terms of the standard preclinical testing? If, for example, for a non-invasive material, there would be 10 tests. Is getting 30% of them complete, in your estimation, good enough to start potentially looking at this application? Or are we talking more like 80% of the tests ready to be able to start?
It totally depends on the novelty of the technology and the intended use, and the, you know, it's very much project dependent. So
yeah.
I would warn you that if you ask FDA, we're going to say 100%. And what we're trying to get away from here is to not have you come in and ask us what needs to be done, but you would look at your device and what it needs to be able to do for the patient population you intend to enroll in your clinical study, and explain to us what information is appropriate, and we work with you to figure that out, to reach agreement on that. For a device that we know exactly how the testing should be done, and it's been done for years, and you just happen to have a new product or you're new into the game, you're probably going to have to do the testing that everyone else has had to do over the last 100 years. But if it's something really unique and we don't know exactly how it should be tested, you know, we have the opportunity to work with you to figure out what makes sense.
Mm-hmm.
So getting back to your animal question, it may be that for a particular device, an indication that the near-term testing may be sufficient to demonstrate acceptable safety and proof of concept or an expectation of proof of concept, and you've reached an acceptable hemodynamic or histological result, you may anticipate doing those longer-term animal studies, but they may not be needed for the initial early feasibility study.
Mm-hmm. Thank you very much. And this will be my last question. With this data package, would it be required to be GLP preclinical testing?
So there's no specific requirement for GLP. We encourage GLP work for all the animal testing, if the tests deviate from GLP, what we would want for you to provide is how those deviations, how the testing deviated for GLP, and why the testing you provide are still valid, and so that we can look at them as objectively as possible.
Thank you very much.
There is a section on GLP in the guidance you might be helpful.
Thank you.
Scott Derland, your line is open. Please check your mute button.
Sorry about that. Can you hear me now?
Yes, we can hear you.
Okay, thank you. Yeah, my question is on the back to the limited number of subjects. My question specifically is, if this is a multi-site study that may have sites outside of the U.S., would those also be included in the consideration for the total number of subjects, or is it only limited to sites within the U.S.?
So our jurisdiction ends at our borders.
Okay.
So we only granting we only be referencing those subjects within the United States. However, within the context of our evaluation of the entire study, of course, we would be interested in the entire clinical experience.
All right. Very good. Thank you.
Kathleen Venom, your line is open.
Hello. I just was wondering, now that you've laid the groundwork with the new approaches for this particular situation, I was wondering if there's any other applicability or any thought to expanding these approaches to other types of studies. For example, I could see that the contingent approval would be ideal for
I'm
a way
sorry.
To...
Excuse me. Ms. Vidham, if you
yes.
could please speak up. We can't
yes.
hear your question.
Okay. Can you hear that better? Is that better?
More, if you could.
Oh, okay. Any better?
There you go.
Okay. I think my phone is not the greatest here. Anyway, what I was saying is that now that you've laid the groundwork in this guidance with the new approaches, I'm wondering if there's any applicability or any thought to expanding them to other types of studies. One area that I think would be ideal would be when you're doing a pivotal study, and if you could use the contingent approval approach to negotiate a continued access, for example, where you're doing a lead study that requires many, many enrollments and also will continue to require many enrollments in a post-approval phase. It would be nice to be able to keep the study centers enrolling and not have to start over again. And I'm wondering if you could propose in your IDE application that you would like to have continued access, assuming you're contingent on a certain outcome of your study or certain amount of evidence. I mean, would FDA consider, you know, applying this now that it's been defined in one guidance to other areas?
Yeah, I think the contingent approval really isn't intended to address expansion of studies, whether you're talking about continued access or moving into a pivotal study. That the intent of that provision is to allow for modifications under the early feasibility study to make sure that you don't have an interruption. I hear what you're saying. You want to make sure that we figure out ways to have a continuous enrollment from early feasibility to traditional, or from early to pivotal, or from pivotal to continued access. And I think it's reasonable to work with your review team to try to figure out how to make that as seamless as possible. But at this point in time, there aren't any plans to come up with a new approach to doing what can already currently be done, where you can come in before you've reached your limits and ask that you be able to expand based on the preliminary data that you have available to you. So the short answer is no, there's no plan to apply those options other ways at this point.
Okay. Thank you.
Amy, your line is open.
Thank you. I was wondering if this program is also applicable in the case where you have a device on the market, but you want to make changes to that device to pursue a different indication.
Yes, it is.
Thank you.
Mitchell Eggers, your line is open.
Yes, thank you. I have a two-part question. The first part has to do with the sequence of the studies. For example, if you were to do an early feasibility study, can you then, upon successful results, jump to a pivotal study? Or do you see this now as a three-part study series where you have the early feasibility, traditional feasibility, followed by the final pivotal study?
So the answer is you can, yes, jump to a pivotal study if the results are supportive of such and that you don't plan to make any further modifications to the device or the procedure. The intent of the guidance is not to add steps. In fact, we made sure that we weren't any that it, nothing here is required. So the answer to jumping to pivotal or another feasibility or another early feasibility is all yes.
Okay, the second part is, can you schedule a pre-IDE meeting going into the early feasibility study?
Yes.
Okay. Thank you very much.
John Allison, your line is now open.
Yes, my question is on your slide 12 about just-in-time testing. The agency talked about acknowledging that some testing can be deferred, and I wondered if you had some examples to help color that thought.
So an example might be that you would do finite element analysis of your device to predict the fatigue properties of it, but you would do the fatigue testing during your early feasibility study or maybe even during a feasibility study. And I think another example may be that there are some testing, there's some testing that you do for characterization of a device, and it may not be necessary to do the full characterization, the four corners testing, for example, of certain parameters, that you may do that level of testing later on.
Okay, thank you.
Our next question comes from Nancy Lowe. Your line is open.
Yes, thank you. From your presentation, can you expand possibly on the non-regulatory clinical trial issues that you mentioned and possibly any other issues that were discovered in the pilot program?
Okay, so the this gets to the idea that FDA is part of a larger clinical trial ecosystem, and part of the success of this program will really depend on good quality submissions, good devices, good investigators, clinical study sites, cooperation from IRBs who understand the process. I think we play a very important role in this clinical trial enterprise, but that was the intent of this question. We're hopeful that when we build this program from the ground up, that it will be successful, but time will tell.
Thank you.
Maria, your line is open.
Thank you. So I understand that the conversation goes around the devices that do need the clinical trials, and I wonder if for the devices class 1 that do not need IDE submission or pre-market approval, how these new rules will change the commercialization or affect these kind of products, the products within this group.
I'm sorry, could you please repeat the question and speak just a little louder, please?
Okay, can you hear me now?
Yes.
Okay. I was saying that this is the conversation goes around pretty much about the devices that do need the clinical trials, and I wonder for devices class 1 that do not need the ID submission or pre-market approval, how these new rules will affect these class 1 devices.
There's no effect on the Class 1 devices because this guidance only applies to significant risk devices that you would need an IDE submission in order to do a clinical evaluation.
So what you're telling me is that we don't need to do anything regarding the Class 1 devices that do not need the IDE submission. Hello?
This is Sheila. Unless you are doing some device modifications that would trip the limitation on your exempt device, no, you do not need to submit clinical data to FDA.
Not even on the labeling of the boxes or anything?
If your device is class 1, it's not affected by this guidance and the feasibility process.
Thank you very much.
Ed, Thomas, your line is open.
Yes, this is Steve Machino. I had a question about the level of software documentation needed to support the submission. We believe we meet the requirements of the guidance document for a early feasibility study. The device is an implantable device that has software, and the software was developed to a product software lifecycle development process. but may not meet all the requirements of, for example, IEC 62304 software development, the standard. Is it acceptable to submit based on, the question is, what level of software development would be needed to support a submission of this type?
You'd need to work with your review team to find out exactly what their expectation would be. But some things that you can suggest to them would be, for example, if the risk of a software failure, it wouldn't be catastrophic, you know, or if the tolerance for risk of the patient population would be such that even if the software failed and the device was completely ineffective, they would be more than willing to take the chance, for example, if you have patients that are extremely limited in mobility. So those are just examples, and you certainly would want to use the pre-submission process to interact with the review team to help figure out what would be needed.
Okay, thank you.
Kim, your line is now open.
Hi, my question's regarding the applicability of this guidance document to in vitro diagnostics, and I guess in the realm of significant risks in vitro diagnostics. And what I'm thinking of is in the companion diagnostics environment where a diagnostic would be used in treatment decisions potentially in phase one pharma studies.
This is Sheila. If your device is determined to be significant risk, which most of these are now, as companion diagnostics, because the results are being used to determine whether or not the patient gets a specific treatment, you could follow this process as well. We strongly recommend for any of these that you come in for pre-submission first. There is a draft guidance that's available on our website.
Okay. All right. There wasn't really any mention of in vitro diagnostics, and I know they're a subset of devices, so I wanted to see if I could clarify.
I'm sorry. Can you speak up? We really can't hear your question.
Sure. I'm sorry. I just wanted to clarify because I know that in vitro diagnostics are a subset of devices, and there really wasn't too much mention of any in vitro diagnostics, so I wanted to be sure.
Yeah, if they meet the realm of significant risk, then this guidance may apply.
And we did work with the people that regulate those devices in drafting the guidance document, so it does talk about therapies and various things other than just implants, which is what Andy and I know about. So it is intended to cover other types of devices. There just may not be as much detail because it's less common.
Great. Thank you.
And again, as a reminder, if you do have any questions or comments, please press star 1 and record your name. Again, please press star 1. We do have a question from Roya. Your line is now open.
Oh, hi. Thank you. Our question is about a non-significant device which doesn't require an IDE. And the question is, would feasibility study be acceptable on a non-significant device that doesn't follow the design control controls and structure?
This is Sheila. Were you planning on just submitting this as a marketing application? Your results?
In the end, yes.
If you need to have clinical data for this, and it's a non-significant risk study, you should go through your IRB. We would strongly recommend that you submit a pre-submission to make sure you're collecting the correct data and that you do have in place the information that we need for your marketing application, or that you will have it available by the time you submit your marketing application.
But non-significant risk devices are outside the scope of this guidance. And, you know, as far as whether you need design controls for non-significant risk devices, we recommend that you talk to our small manufacturers assistance? The answer is yes, you need design controls. We happen to have an expert sitting right here.
Thank you so much.
Alex Stout, your line is now open.
Yes, hello, thank you. We think these questions have already been answered, but if you would just confirm if a sponsor should conduct an early feasibility study in a device that has PMA approval for another indication?
Yes, for a new indication, for approved device, the guidance can be applied.
And would you recommend a pre-submission meeting in this instance?
Yes.
Okay, thank you very much.
And our last question comes from Amrita. Your line is now open.
Thank you. My question is, does this guidance apply to first-in-humans HUD studies?
I'm sorry, can you repeat the question, please?
Sorry, I said, does this guidance apply to first-in-human HUD studies?
If you're, are you talking about a study that will be used to support a submission for a humanitarian use product?
That's correct.
Okay. Then yes, it would.
It would. Okay.
It would. If the device or the study is significant risk, yes, it would apply.
It would apply. Okay. Thank you very much.
We have another question that came through from Penny Cooter. Your line is now open.
Hi. You may have just answered this question with the last caller, but I didn't quite hear the whole thing. My company is trying to obtain a humanitarian device exemption approval for a device. Are the requirements different for first-in-human studies as opposed to the humanitarian device exemption requirements?
They're really two entirely different processes. First-in-human or an IDE is a clinical trial to obtain data for a marketing application. An HDE is a marketing application in which you would submit the data from your IDE.
Okay,
does that
thank you.
Answer your question?
Yes, it's made it a little clearer. I think I just need to do some more research. Thank you.
Okay, there is an HDE guidance that's available on FDA's website, as well as this first-in-human guidance and information on IDEs in general.
Hiya, Westbrook, your line is open.
Yes, thank you. I just wanted some clarification on changes to the protocol that you mentioned that could be done through either five-day notifications or through contingent approval. What types of protocol changes are typical examples? Like, would changes to inclusion-exclusion criteria fall within that category?
So it's possible they might, as long as they don't impact the usual rights, welfare, and safety of individuals. Another example might be you've done your first six patients and you determined that the imaging that you performed on day three wasn't all that informative. It didn't really help. You may present a use of the five-day notification to eliminate testing that may not be informative.
Okay, thank you very much. And one last update to that. So I believe you mentioned earlier that expansion of that feasibility should not be done through contingent approval. What is the fastest route to go from the initial early feasibility to expanding that cohort?
We'll answer that question in a minute, but I think Sheila had another comment about the first question.
Regarding your first question, we also have a guidance on FDA's website regarding changes and modifications to a study.
So I think the best way forward in terms of expansion of the early feasibility study is that you'd come in and speak with the communicate with the review team where you are at with respect to your ongoing study and why it's appropriate at that point to either continue to ask for expansion for additional patients under the early feasibility study, either with the same device that you have to collect more information or if you have changes that you want to make to the device or procedure, apply those to the next cohort of individuals. Alternatively, as we've discussed, if the data and the device and the procedure support a larger study, you would talk to the review team again about your plans to go to a larger feasibility study or even a pivotal trial. So I think that the first step would be to communicate with the review team.
But ultimately, a 30-day supplement would be necessary.
Okay. Thank you very much.
And if you do have any further questions, please press star 1 and record your name. We do have a question from Mary DeBoer. Your line is now open.
Thank you. I just wanted to know if it's possible these guidelines might apply to a combination device drug product?
Yes.
Thank you.
In those situations, we would get consultations from our CDER colleagues.
Thank you.
I have no further questions.
So with no further questions, we want to thank you for the questions that you did provide today. This concludes our webinar, and for further questions, please contact either Dorothy or Andrew at the contact information that was provided in this slide presentation. And this presentation will be available on the CDRH Learn website, along with a recording of this discussion within the next couple days. Actually, the presentation will be available today. The recording will probably be uploaded on Monday. So if you have any questions, please contact us, and thank you very much.
This concludes today's conference call. Thank you for participating. You may disconnect at this time.